The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hey, good morning. My name is Kevin Barker, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Administrative Law Review. On behalf of the Law Review's editorial board and staff, I'd like to welcome everyone to our 2010 symposium, Regulatory Change Under the Obama Administration. This symposium has been in the works for quite some time. It really started when Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria, was assassinated in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. Of course, his assassination led to World War I. World War I began the Roaring Twenties, which led to the great stock market crash of 1929. That crash precipitated the Great Depression, which led to the rise in the election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, the creation of 18 new federal agencies, and the rapid expansion of federal agency power. This caused some concern that the administrative state had become too powerful. And after many years of debate, Congress passed the Administrative Procedure Act in 1946 to standardize agency process. Because of all the new attention being given to administrative law, the ABA decided to publish a quarterly bulletin in 1949, which was renamed the Administrative Law Review in 1960. In 1997, the Administrative Law Review merged with the Administrative Law Journal of the American University, and the publication began sponsoring an annual symposium. On November 4th, 2008, 52.9% of the United States electorate voted to elect President Barack Obama. Upon taking office, President Obama began to effect change in regulatory policy, and the Administrative Law Review decided to make that the subject of its annual symposium. And so we are here today. I'd like to thank a few people who have been instrumental to this event. First, I would like to thank Mr. Cass Sunstein for speaking at this symposium and welcome him to American University Washington College of Law. It's our great honor to host you today, and we're really looking forward to your remarks. I'd also like to thank Mel Barris, our senior symposia editor, who's truly put together a first-rate program, as well as the ABA section of Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice, the co-publisher of the Administrative Law Review. I'd like to thank Professors Andrew Popper, Jeff Lubbers, Anna Gelpern, David Snyder, Anthony Verona, William Snape, and Stephen Ramil. Without their help, the tremendous lineup of speakers we have today wouldn't have been possible. And our thanks go straight to the top of the law school. Dean Claudio Grossman took the time to work personally with us in developing this event, and we are grateful for his efforts and for his commitment to the students at this law school. Dean Grossman is in his 16th year as Dean of American University Washington College of Law, and over the course of his tenure, has directed the dramatic growth and vitalization of this institution. Among his many accomplishments, he is the chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture and chair of the Committee on International Cooperation of the Association of American Law Schools. In May of last year, he was named to the judging panel for the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award by the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. I would like to thank and welcome Dean Claudio Grossman to our symposium.
Thanks, Kevin, for your generous introduction. What Kevin forgot to mention is that I just returned from litigating a case in the Inter-American Court on Human Rights in Latin America, and I spoke English very well before I went there, and I returned with this accent. I'm sure after a while it's going to get better. It's a long while, however. I'm very pleased to be here and welcome everyone to this founder event, Regulatory Changes Under the Obama Administration, presented by the Administrative Law Review. This is a very important topic, and we're going to hear about it. But what's crucial also for anyone to understand is that the law school has a strong commitment with the assisting in the formulation of public policy. And there's hardly an issue that lacks a legal component. And then we have defined strategically as part of the vision of this law school, the creation of a space where people can come and debate from every perspective important issues facing the community, the nation, and the world. This is related also to the commitment of our founding mothers. There are very few institutions that have founding mothers, and we're one proud institution that claimed that to belong to that category. We were created in 1896 by two women in a moment where women were not allowed into legal education and into a practice of the profession, and they said they thought that it was essential to have an educational institution open to women and men alike, and to have women that will live in the world and in the domain of procedures and institutions as a condition to achieve equality. So this combination of commitment, the belief in the law, the idea that we can be relevant by addressing key issues, and also offering a public service by addressing issues of our time, is what motivates this colloquium. On behalf of our community, I want to thank all the participants in today's program, including our opening keynote speakers, the Honorable Kasar Sunstein, the luncheon keynote speakers, the President of AU, Neil Kerwitt, and our many distinguished panelists and speakers. I mean, thanks to them, we can perform this function, and that is crucial, as I said before, not only for those who have an interest in regulatory matters, but for the public as a whole. And let me say also that we can do these events. We have over 60 in the spring only, thanks to a very motivated and committed student body that really bodes well for the future of this profession. In spite of the debt of law students, the commitment that it means to study in the institution and the sleepless nights that go with it, our students find time to engage themselves in addressing key issues of our times while they are here in the law school. And our admiration goes to them. They are the best that we have to offer. And again, we have over 60 colloquium, and many of them are organized by our student body. In particular, I want to thank the editor-in-chief, Kevin Barker, and Mel Barras, the symposium editor. Both of them are tireless advocates for the administrative law review and for the interest of the students in this institution, as well as the entire staff of the administrative law review for sponsoring and organizing this important event. A few comments about ALR. There are 90 student members, began in 1987, and in 1996 became the Administrative Law Review, which is published in conjunction with the ABA section of Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice. It's the only ABA journal that is run entirely by students. For your information, about 19 others are headed by practicing attorneys and law professors. Has the largest circulation rate of any student-run law review in the United States, around 8,500 copies distributed internally four times a year. Has been cited by U.S. courts, including the U.S. Court of Appeal for the D.C. Circuit, Second Circuit, Fourth Circuit, Fifth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and Tenth Circuit. It is committed to publishing scholarship from our law students. This year alone, at least 13 students will be published. Assisted in revising administrative law rules of the forthcoming edition of the Blue Book, the Standard Legal Citation Manual. It's guided also the law school's ALR, and has the cooperation by an expert faculty board consisting of 10 of our professors, including Professors Tony Verona and Steve Wermel, who are participating in today's event, as well as Professors Anna Gelper and William Snapes. And I want to mention at the end Professor Popper, because all of them have volunteered the time, expertise throughout the planning of today's symposium. Now, Andy Popper is the person who interacts a lot with me, and he has really put all his time and effort in the realization, and thinking in terms of the interest of the law students, and you are, together with our colleagues, you are fortunate to have colleagues like him in our faculty and the others who participate in this symposium. Other faculty board members are Gary Edels, Louis Grossman, Jeff Lawrence, who is also here and is a very important personality in the realm of administrative law, Dean Mark Knight, Adin Postar, Jemin Raskin, and Robert Bond. I want to thank the Office of Special Events also. They are in a very delicate situation, organizing, as I said, over 60 panels and conferences since in the spring only, and this that attracting over 10,000 individuals to this law school. So that's not a small accomplishment. Well, finally, I want to introduce today's opening keynote speakers, the Honorable Kath R. Sunstein, Administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA, of the Office of Management and Budget. Mr. Sunstein was nominated to a position of Administrator of OIRA by President Obama on April 20, 2009. President Obama, when announced his nomination, said that Mr. Sunstein is one of America's leading constitutional scholars, and that he has distinguished himself in a range of fields, including administrative law and policy, environmental law, behavioral economics. He's an equally qualified to lead President Obama's administration regulatory reform, he said, agenda at this crucial stage in our history. Cass is not only a valued advisor, he's a dear friend, and I'm proud to have him on my team. End quote. Mr. Sunstein is, as we all know, a prominent legal scholar. When he joined the faculty of Harvard Law School as the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law, the Dean, now Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, said, quote, Cass Sunstein is the preeminent legal scholar of our time, the most wide-ranging, the most prolific, and the most cited, and the most influential. End quote. He has written in a variety of legal fields, including administrative law, policy, constitutional law and theory, behavioral economics and law, environmental law, and jurisprudential theory. You can read further about his resume. We want to hear now from him. He's, as I said before, a prominent legal scholar, widely published. We're proud to have him in our community, and we welcome him to come here. Please, Mr. Sunstein, thank you.
Well, thank you so much to the Dean, to the Law Review for immense kindness and generosity in inviting me. To be at this institution is a pleasure and an honor. It occupies a unique place in American legal education. It's really great to be here. The Administrative Law Review is also a journal, would be slightly too strong to say, with which I've been obsessed over the years, but I am a very loyal and careful reader. What's published by the Administrative Law Review is immensely influential in the community, and it is exceedingly high quality, and I'm just grateful for the continuing work. To the students here, I know that this is a time of challenge for the legal profession, but I have one thing to say, which is you're really becoming lawyers when your country most needs you. This is not only a challenge, but a fabulous time to be contributing to our legal system, and we're excited to have you as part of the community. Welcome to all of you. I have two epigraphs for you. One is from an American law professor named Carl Llewellyn, who said many years ago, technique without morals is a menace, but morals without technique is a mess. My second epigraph is from our president, President Obama, who said in October in an executive order on economic, environmental, and energy performance, it is the policy of the United States that agencies shall prioritize actions based on a full accounting of economic and social benefits and costs, and shall drive continuous improvement by annually evaluating performance, extending projects that have net benefits, and reassessing or discontinuing underperforming projects. Thus our president declaring in October national policy. In the last year and more, regulators in the United States have embarked on three enterprises that I'd like to highlight here. They cut across the federal government, they cut across the executive branch, and my belief is they're having real impacts on the lives of ordinary Americans, including students, for reasons I'll get to shortly. The first direction is that we've been trying to do regulatory policy with Homo sapiens rather than Homo economicus. That is, we've been trying to bring to bear on regulatory policy an accurate sense rather than a fanciful sense of how human beings actually behave and what human beings are actually like. That's the first direction. Direction number two, we've tried to engage in cost-benefit analysis, notice the president's words in October, in a way that is at least as rigorous as ever before, I hope more rigorous than ever before, but also in a way that is humanized in the sense that it takes account of qualitative as well as quantitative considerations, monetized values aren't all that matter. It takes account of distributional considerations. Are people in distress being helped or hurt? And it takes account emphatically of the interests of future generations. So our second direction has been humanized cost-benefit analysis. Third, we've attempted more than ever before in the regulatory domain to ensure open and transparent government. We've tried, in two words, to democratize data. These are three linked enterprises, and I'm going to describe each of them. You've now heard the text of the remarks. What's coming are the footnotes, but as readers of law reviews know, sometimes the footnotes are a bit longer than the text. Decades of work in social science have uncovered certain features of the species Homo sapiens, four of which bear particularly on regulatory policy. We know that human beings often have a tendency toward unrealistic optimism. 90% of drivers think that they are better than the average driver and less likely to be involved in a serious accident. If you consider yourself less safe than the average driver, you're an unusual person. If you take two people in a couple and ask what percentage of the household work each thinks he or she does, if the percentage isn't over 100%, you have a very unusual couple. With respect to heart disease, cancer, et cetera, human beings typically believe that they're less at risk than the usual human being. In fact, smokers tend to have a statistically accurate sense of the reality of risk faced by smokers. Sometimes they even exaggerate the statistical risk, but they underestimate their personal risk. Smokers typically believe that they are themselves more immune from cancer risk than the average non-smoker. We know, second, with respect to human beings, that inertia is a very powerful force. The status quo has dominant effects on behavior, even where a change from the status quo would be in people's interests. I got a good lesson in this in the last few years because about 15 years ago, the American Express Company made me a nice offer. They said you could have five magazines for free for the next 3 months if you just check boxes. And while I didn't like any of the magazines they were offering, how can you lose five magazines for free for 3 months? I find myself now, many years later, still subscribing to the magazines, but for the last 14 years and 9 months, I've been paying for them. More concretely, in terms of policy, social scientists discovered, actually quite recently, that people aren't saving for retirement at the level where you'd expect, because to get into a 401k program, they have to opt in. And even though it's very easy to opt in, the enrollment rate for under opt-in is surprisingly low. If people are automatically enrolled, the rate shoots up, even if they can opt out just by checking a box. This is a very dramatic finding about the effects of inertia on ultimate outcomes. We know not only are people unrealistically optimistic in many domains, prone to the influence of inertia, we know as well that people are greatly influenced by whether an incident of badness or goodness is cognitively available in the sense that it readily comes to mind. Many Americans, when they're asked how many words on a random page will end with the last three letters ing, will give a higher number than if they're asked how many words on a random page have as the second to last letter N. That can't be true, but that is how people often answer such questions. The reason is ing words you can instantly identify, likely to be 20 or 30 on a big page. Second to last letter N, it's cognitively less available. We know that people typically believe more people die from homicides than suicides, though the opposite is true, and the reason is that homicides are cognitively available in a way suicides aren't. I was told just coming into this room by Jeff Lubbers that the snow risk is typically exaggerated by people whose profession it is accurately to describe snow risks in the immediate aftermath of terrible snows. in a way that shows the power of the availability heuristic, which can lead both to overestimation and underestimation of risk, depending on whether a recent event has comes easily to mind. And I bet each of us can think of our own lives of cases in which the recent occurrence of an event for us personally or for our government has driven our behavior and our fear or our complacency in a particular direction. We know finally, this is my fourth of the quartet of Homo sapiens, a little different from Homo economicus, that people are very much affected by the influence of others in the sense that the social network in which one finds oneself often dominates behavior. Obesity is contagious. If people find themselves in groups of people who are overweight, the likelihood that they themselves will be overweight jumps. Flu shots, it turns out, are contagious. The likelihood that people will get flu shots depends very much on whether people in their community have gotten flu shots. I confess that I am myself vaccinated, and the reason is that I happened to run into a friend of mine in the floor of the White House, and he was going to get vaccinated, and so I went to get vaccinated exactly for that reason. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about an experiment seemingly far afield from the domain of regulation, because I think it has profound implications about some of the efforts in which we've engaged over the last months. It involves music downloads. The control version of the experiment, if you're with me, is a little bit like ordinary life. It's like iTunes, where you can download songs on a website after hearing 30 seconds, and you know nothing about how many other people have downloaded the songs. This is a real experiment involving thousands of people about the age of law students and younger. 28 bands, you can hear a little bit, and you can download. If you have thousands of people, you get a kind of ranking in terms of what people like for these relatively unknown bands. That's the control. In seven other iterations of the experiment, people were sorted randomly into virtual worlds in the sense that with the magic of the computer, they could see how many people in their artificially designed world had downloaded which songs of the 28. We could do that experiment in this group where each segment of the room could be sorted into a group which could see how many people in that segment of the room downloaded the relevant songs. This was a test of the power of social influence on music download choices, yes? The hypothesis with which the authors played was that basically quality wins, and the songs that did great in the control would also do great in the seven other worlds. That hypothesis was defeated. Well, it turns out that the best songs were never complete disasters in the social influence world, and the horribly unpopular songs in the control were never at the very top. Otherwise, anything could happen. Songs that were 4 in the control could be 24 in the social influence. Songs that were 22 in the social influence could end up 3. 22 in the control could end up 3 in the social influence. This is a profound demonstration of the immense power of social norms on behavior. And I'm going to give a couple of examples where an insight like this has implications for regulatory policy. Okay, those are 4 phenomena. Now I'm going to go to policy. First, we have worked very hard to see how much default rules and simplification can operate to help people in the regulatory domain. The President has had a series of initiatives for building on the automatic enrollment finding in order to assure American workers an easier path towards more prosperous retirements. We've done a great deal to encourage employers to have automatic enrollment policies for retirement and to encourage employers and employees to ensure that they're in those 401k plans, which are in their self-interest. This is one of the president's announcements the day before the State of the Union address, part of the Middle Class Task Force plan, and it is a case study in the use of automatic enrollment and default rules to try actually to improve people's lives. Example number two. How many of you filled out the financial, well, that's maybe a privacy question. I might be violating something. Don't answer this question. My guess is at least some of you filled out the federal financial aid application form, which the FAFSA form, which is famously complicated, difficult, elaborate, so much so that our best data suggests a significant number of people aren't getting financial aid and aren't going to college just because the form is such a mess. What we've done in a very short time is radical simplification of the form, so much so that it's influencing students who are applying to for college aid right now. In January 1st, we approved a new form, and we have new steps in this direction to make things a lot easier for people. In the domain of risk regulation, something of particular concern to me and my job, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has proposed a new rule involving hazard communication, which will involve simpler hazard communication, more coordination with European methods. It will both save costs and save lives on our best projections. It's not quite a default rule, but it's in the domain of simplification. My guess is no one in this room is on Social Security, but there's an innovation with which we're working that's in the same family, and it involves the Direct Express program for Social Security, by which people get a card that's a debit card where their money is, rather than a check. It's simpler, it's easier, it's like a default rule. Our projection is it's going to help save the government money and save the recipients convenience and, in the end, money as well. There's been a great deal of talk about our Consumer Financial Product Agency. There's a great public debate about the agency and what form it should take. If you look at our bill, the agency has as a key mission disclosure policies to ensure that people actually know what they're getting into with respect to mortgages, credit cards, and more. And if you look at the disclosure policies, they deal with Homo sapiens, not Homo economicus. This is simplified transparency rather than complicated, endless forms. I'm going to have a lot more to say about disclosure. Just a clue here that if we take default rules and simplification seriously, we will have an engine by which to reevaluate our disclosure policies. That's default rules and simplification. The case of obesity and the case of flu vaccinations suggest that social norms greatly matter to people's behavior. We know with respect to smoking and seatbelt usage, there have been very significant changes in behavior, saving lots of lives. And what's happened there at its best is that regulation and private norms have operated hand in hand, fortifying one another. In fact, there's a nice paper on tobacco regulation with the title Compliance Without Enforcement. It's worth thinking about that phenomenon, especially in a law school. Why is it and when is it that you'll get compliance without enforcement? With smoking, the apparent reason for widespread, kind of miraculous compliance without enforcement is there are social norms, so that if people in most relevant places lit up a cigarette in violation of law, there'd be private enforcement, or ostracism, or at least complaints. That's kind of a case study in the power of social norms interacting with regulation. If you look at two initiatives in the last year that have tremendous promise, some of it already being realized, you'll see that they are ensuring that government action and private action are operating hand in hand. The first involves the Department of Transportation, whose secretary has been very concerned with the problem of texting while driving. He held a summit not long ago in which both experts in the technical material and victims of texting while driving spoke about what they knew. It was an overwhelming experience both to see the range of data on the risks associated with texting while driving and to see the people who had actually suffered. Sometimes their family members had lost their lives as a result of a form of behavior which is increasingly prevalent. What the Secretary of Transportation has done with kind of remarkable energy and focus is to take steps that are not aggressive, that attempt to work with private institutions to get this very risky, low-benefit behavior under control. The initial step was actually a most unusual executive order from the President of the United States, which simply banned texting while driving by federal employees. Associate Administrator Fitzpatrick and I are not allowed to text while driving. We have to answer to the President if we do that. That executive order is having beneficial effects in the sense that it's stopping federal employees from doing something that creates risks. But it's also part of an interaction with private institutions and social norms. If you follow the path of the Department of Transportation here, this has not been heavy-handed aggressive regulation. It's had a big public education component, and it's trying to ensure that those in a position to injure others, like commercial bus drivers, aren't engaging in this form of behavior. Much more recently, the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, has announced her leadership of a program designed to control childhood obesity. And if we think of health problems faced by Americans, the problem of childhood obesity is a really serious one. It's associated with a very wide range of health hazards, costing lives, causing suffering, and costing a great deal of money as well. If you look at the proposals she has in mind, every single one of them has to do with social norms and trying to alter social norms which are damaging to health and encourage social norms that are desirable for health. I just have one other behavioral point, and then we'll get to humanized cost-benefit analysis, and this has to do with energy use. We in the administration are greatly concerned about the environmental, economic, and national security problems created by excessive use of high-polluting energy. And we'd like to figure out what to do about that. The company in Southern California a number of years ago was also concerned about the same series of problems, and it attempted a range of interventions to try to get people not to use so much energy. It used education. It used moral suasion. It appealed to people's conscience. Nothing worked. Finally, the company gave people a little globe, an ambient orb, it's called. And the ambient orb would glow green in their kitchen when their energy use was low. And it would glow red in their kitchen when their energy use was high. That intervention reduced energy consumption by 40% in the relevant groups. What's profound, I think, about this little tale is that it suggests a possible link between the behavioral economists, Daniel Kahneman is the Nobel Prize winner, and Adam Smith, where this is free markets. This is not heavy-handed government regulation. What it does is it uses free markets and incentives, but it notices the great importance of salience to people's behavior. Incentives matter, sure, but only if they are salient. And notice, if you would, with respect to so many of our interactions with private and public institutions, our conclusions are driven by what's salient to us. What we've done in the domain of salience has kind of two headliners. First, the new tobacco legislation has clear instruction to the Food and Drug Administration to try to have graphic, clear warnings, more graphic, more novel, more attention-grabbing than anything we've seen before, in a way that will make salient and kind of gripping the health risks associated with smoking. We think that has a great deal of potential. In an executive order that is much longer than the texting while driving executive order, the president issued one involving energy use by the federal government itself. That has ambitious targets and timetables for us to get our own house in order. And one thing you'll see in the next year under the executive order is that our own energy use, our own use of taxpayer resources in this domain is highly salient to agencies all over the federal government in ways it might not be before. That may be useful for private institutions which are themselves attempting to save money and in the process protect the environment. Okay, I'm done with the first of our three directions over the last year. The second involves cost-benefit analysis. Controversial in some quarters, to be sure. We have tried to be very disciplined and careful about cost-benefit analysis. The office that Michael and I run has, as part of its charge, to ensure that before the government does something that's very expensive, there is some kind of public accounting of the costs and the benefits of action. So the American public can see and weigh in on the rule with a high degree of transparency about its actual effects. Let me give three examples. How many of you heard about the passenger protection rule from the Department of Transportation? It got a lot of attention in December. The basic idea is if you're flying domestically, you can't be kept on the tarmac for more than 3 hours. And you also get food and water and medical care, if you need it, within 2 hours. That rule is accompanied by an extremely disciplined analysis of its costs and benefits. If we're imposing financial burdens on airlines, we want to catalog them as best we can and make sure that the benefits justify the action. There's an effort to be disciplined about everything we're gaining from that regulation before we go forward with it. And that's out there for the public to see. The president personally announced the elimination of the HIV entry ban in a step that meant a great deal to the administration. That elimination of the HIV entry ban has a regulatory impact analysis that has a very systematic account of the health effects, good and bad, associated with the elimination of the ban. Not only does it have ranges of adverse and beneficial health effects, it has point estimates saying exactly how many we expect to be affected in what ways. I referred to the worker communication rule trying to give more clarity to workers and to employers about how they communicate hazards to employees. This rule has an extremely systematic cost-benefit analysis, projecting, incidentally, dozens of lives will be saved every year. We have that out now for public review. If we're wrong, we want to hear about it and get it right. Very disciplined cost-benefit analysis. At the same time that we have numbers and quantities, we have taken very seriously the president's suggestion in January that we consider three variables not always foremost in the minds of cost-benefit proponents: future generations, distributional considerations, and fairness. This is what I mean by humanized cost-benefit analysis rather than something that reduces complex social problems to questions of arithmetic. I referred to the passenger protection rule from the Department of Transportation, something that we think will make life easier, more convenient for the American people. That rule is explained in ways that take on board the fact that there's anxiety for people who are thirsty or hungry or sick on the tarmac. It does the best it can to try to monetize those feelings, but it refers to them in qualitative as well as quantitative form, and it doesn't pretend that the monetary figures are exhaustive. In the domain of greenhouse gas emissions, we have to do cost-benefit analysis. to figure out the benefits of greenhouse gas emission reduction, we need a number. Early in the administration, we created a social cost of carbon. What is the social cost of a ton of carbon emissions? The number that we generated, just interim, it's out for public comment to try to get it right, does two things. First, it recognizes that future generations are adversely affected by climate change, by the scientific projections. And we are building on the science in its latest state at every stage. If the numbers change, make it look more harmful or less harmful, we'll take that on board. But future generations are at risk, and we consider that. We also consider the fact that people in poor nations, such as India and China, are at risk from climate change, and Africa. That harm to others is something we consider in our action to the extent required by, to the extent permitted by law. I referred to the elimination of the HIV entry ban. And if you would indulge me, I'm just going to read to you, I hope this is the only time in your lives you'll actually hear a regulatory impact analysis. Reading one, I hope you will do, but to hear it aloud is like a little awful. But here we go. The primary benefit of this rule is that each year an additional 4,275 immigrants, point estimate, who otherwise qualify for entry but are now denied based solely on HIV status, will now be able to enter the United States. Although we are unable to quantify all of the benefits of this change in policy, we believe it will help reduce stigmatization of HIV-infected people, bring family members together who had been barred from entry, and allow HIV-infected immigrants with skills in high demand to enter the U.S. to seek employment and contribute as productive members of U.S. society. And if they are able to obtain better health care in the United States, to improve health outcomes and productivity. There are also ethical, humanitarian, distributional, and international benefits that are important but difficult to quantify. Thus, humanized cost-benefit analysis. The third domain is open government and democratizing data. And if you remember anything from these remarks, a good candidate would be that we have taken more aggressive steps toward opening up the data held by the federal government and using that data to try to improve people's lives than any government has done before. The president, early in the administration, signaled 3 points, each of which has an academic pedigree, good law professor that he was. He said first that he wanted open government in order to ensure that there is information out there that people can readily find and use. The instruction to the regulatory state is make material available to people that they can use to improve their own lives. The second thing he said was sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants. Here, quoting Justice Brandeis, speaking of the power of accountability to change behavior. We are trying very hard not only to make private institutions accountable for behavior that raises legal and other problems, but also to make ourselves accountable for what we are actually doing. Third, he said, what we're trying to do with openness and transparency is to bring into government dispersed knowledge. That is knowledge that is dispersed throughout society, but that bureaucrats and government officials are unlikely to have. By this reference to dispersed knowledge, think if you would of Wikipedia, which I do like, though my own Wikipedia page I don't like as much as I did a year and a half ago. Think Wikipedia, open source software, blogs, wikis generally, where there's phenomenal dispersed information that we can benefit from, but that individuals and even experts don't have. With his reference to dispersed knowledge, the president was picking up on a tradition that goes back to Aristotle, who wrote about how groups will have a kind of wisdom individuals will lack, however brilliant the individuals are, and more precisely to Friedrich Hayek, the great critic of socialism in the 20th century, whose most important work is captured in a 1946 essay called The Uses of Knowledge in Society, where Hayek said in 46, when centralized planning was running high in the world, "No," said Hayek, "the centralized planner, no matter how expert and knowledgeable, can never beat a market, because the centralized planner just won't know as much." That was Hayek's great insight. What Hayek said was the market will capture the dispersed knowledge of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of users, and will just be much more informed for that reason than any central planner can be. What the president referred to with dispersed knowledge is our current potential to work miracles, really, that Hayek couldn't have anticipated by virtue of the potential to aggregate knowledge and to do things with it. Okay, what have we done with respect to these three enterprises? Readily find and use, dispersed knowledge, sunlight is the best of disinfectants. Well, early on, we created an information technology dashboard. You can find it in an instant on the internet. The information technology dashboard tells anyone in the world, really, I think even in China they can find it, information about our own information technology investments and how they're going. Are they going on time? Are there cost overruns? How are they rated? If the Department of Defense has a lot of greens, everyone can see that. If the Environmental Protection Agency has some reds, everyone can see that. Very shortly after the information technology dashboard came up, there were changes, with bad contracts being dropped. One of its first actions in the area of greenhouse gas regulation, so to speak, actually, for reasons we'll get to very quickly, is from the EPA, is a greenhouse gas reporting rule, where what the EPA is doing is saying, report your emissions so we know what they are. That builds on the toxic release inventory, which was just a disclosure requirement. No one anticipated it, but the toxic release inventory drove down toxic emissions because no one wanted to be one of the highest polluters. Sunlight is the best of disinfectants. In multiple domains, we are trying to disclose information to the American public, hoping that it will ensure that people have information they can find and use, that we'll get access to dispersed knowledge, or that sunlight will work as a disinfectant. If you go on OSHA.gov, you will see, for the first time, fatality information. If any American dies in the workplace, where OSHA has access to the information, and OSHA has a lot of access, that's going to be up there within a matter of weeks, and the company's identified. It's not a regulatory requirement, it's a disinfectant. The early anecdotes are that no company wants to be on OSHA.gov at the place where a worker died last week. And as a result, that disclosure requirement is having significant effects on workplace safety. We're hoping to build on that idea in many domains. The Department of Transportation has been a pioneer here. It's recently released data on car safety, on infant safety seats, on much more that involves highway safety. The USDA, very much focused on nutrition and obesity, has more information out there than ever before. There's a proposed rule for the first time to label the nutritional content of beef and meat. And for the first time ever, the Food and Drug Administration, the First Lady announced this, is thinking very seriously about front of the package labeling in a way that will give people clear and concise and salient information about the health quality of food. Does this have anything to do with cost-benefit analysis? I think so. In its best form, cost-benefit analysis is part of the project of democratizing data. especially in the current economic climate, if the U.S. government is going to be imposing aggressive regulation, people ought to see what they're losing and what they're getting and have some input. Maybe there's a way of doing it that's cheaper. Maybe there's a way of doing it that's better. Maybe there's a way of doing it that's less aggressive. Maybe more stringency is desirable because the costs are low. We want to promote democratic participation. Okay, I'm done. There are three ideas here. The first is that we've attempted to ensure that regulation is behaviorally informed. We are alert to ways in which Homo sapiens departs for Homo economicus, and we are trying very hard to use simplification and default rules to try to make people's lives better and longer. We are concerned about analytic discipline, and we want to know the consequences of regulation before we get going. But this inquiry into costs and benefits is emphatically humanized in the sense that we follow the president's direction to consider fairness, future generations, distributional considerations, and the sheer limits of monetary equivalence. We've tried, third, to have an open and transparent regulatory system. We want to have a lot of data out there. If you look at data.gov, there's been a torrent of material released in a relatively short time. We want to provide material that people can readily find and use, in the president's words, and that will drive behavior in better directions. I said we are in a time of economic difficulty. That is very clear. But with respect to regulation, we have unprecedented opportunities. We know more now than we ever did. We have more awareness of tools, of what works and what doesn't. I began with a quotation from Carl Llewellyn, and I'm going to end with Llewellyn too. The fact is that the quotation was never written down by Professor Llewellyn, and it has two different by Scuttlebutt versions. I'm going to give you now the second version and see if you notice a subtle but important difference. The second version goes like this. Morals without technique is a mess, but technique without morals is a menace. I hope we'll keep both versions of this epigraph in mind as we proceed. Thanks.
My name is Christina Studd. I'm a 2L and a member of the ALR staff. You talked about drawing lessons from various disciplines such as social sciences other than economics to shape the law and policy, and the JD degree is a generalist degree, but many people advise specializing in one area to develop a narrow expertise. And I was wondering, as someone who rose to a position where you can change American policy, what advice you would give for two-part question. The general question is what advice you'd give to WCL students to be outrageously successful in the law or policymaking? And in particular, what advice would you give to one interested in the way that the law shapes how business shapes, sorry, a little nervous, shapes business decisions that affect the environment.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. On the first part, outrageously successful, I'll tell you a story. My friend and co-author, Richard Thaler, who, remember the name if you would, because he's likely to get the Nobel Prize in the next 5 years. He invented behavioral economics. He gave a speech a few years ago when he said, when he was just starting out as an economist, he started doing this behavioral stuff, which at the time there wasn't such a thing. And people told him, this is terrible. It's not a field. It's a disaster. You're going to fail. And he didn't take their advice. They said, why don't you be a regular economist rather than a behavioral economist? And he said he went the route he did for two reasons. First, he wasn't a very good economist. They said he couldn't do real economics great. And second, and even more important, he found it was a lot of fun. He loved it. So he thought, that's the best hedge. Even if he'd failed, he'd succeeded, because he had a great time during it. Now, in a way, that's too strong, but I think it points in the right direction. So I would say the best advice for being outrageously successful is try to figure out something you love to do. So if you did it for 8 hours, that would be great. That's a hedge against it's not going great, and it increases the likelihood that it will go well. As an academic, I would have sometimes, not often, but it was like a little feeling of tickle, a little like being tickled on something that I was really enjoying. And when that was going, then I would know we were on the right track. So everyone, I think, has their own equivalent of that. So I would look for that little feeling maybe on the neck. In terms of law shaping the environment, well, it's a large question. There are many things to be done, and you might think of what domain in particular are you interested in. There's air pollution is an area where great progress has been made, and great progress can continue to be made. So there's an environmental justice issue that is raised by air pollution and other environmental issues that are very important to attend to. Of course, climate change remains relatively new in terms of its interaction with the law. You asked particularly about law-shaping business. One thing that's very good to see and that we could see a lot more is ways that businesses can find to be environmentally friendly or at the same time do better economically. So our own executive order on energy, economic, and environmental performance, an unwieldy but revealing name, our belief is that we can reduce pollution and help taxpayers. So to look for opportunities like that, that's good. But the general area to which you point, it's there's so many opportunities for so many different kinds of work. Water pollution is a high priority. If you're interested internationally, so many people all over the globe are facing serious health risks because of environmental problems.
My name is Jonathan Zimmer. I'm a staff member of the Administrative Law Review, and I'm a third-year eating student. You were talking about transparency and how that is important to the Obama administration, and about how you're trying to design regulations for Homo sapiens and not Homo economicus. Regulators are themselves, at least I hope so, Homo sapiens as well. Part of the problem is assuring that, you know, first the data exists, and that it is being correctly analyzed. A couple of months ago, there was a minor embarrassment for the administration where data reported under the American Reinvestment Recovery Act was that money was being allocated, according to the database, to non-existent congressional districts. And there's also the question of standards being slid down in order to hide bad data. One of the persistent problems in education funding, for example, is there is a lowering of standards to make bad data actually look like good data. So going along with that, how do you ensure that quality data both exists and that it reflects real-world standards? What is the administration doing about this?
That's a great point. Thank you for that. And you're completely right about the central importance of accurate data and also the fact that regulators are Homo sapiens, too. They're prone to error. So if you look at the catalog with which I began of kind of behaviorally informed steps, one thing that's nice about them is that they kind of take on board the risk of government error. Like if a disclosure policy is disclosing things that aren't helpful, then people can say, yeah, whatever. So the kind of light touch behavioral approaches are less risky from the standpoint of fallible government. In terms of the accuracy of data, we are very concerned about that. And if you look at the Open Government Directive issued by the Office of Management and Budget, it is in Section 2 squarely on that, where the Deputy Director for Management, Jeff Zients, has been charged with ensuring data quality. And we are all over that. That's not to say that there will be no inaccuracy, but the sheer volume of material we're providing and the care we're exercising to ensure that it's right, people are spending a lot of time on that. We did have, under the Open Government Directive, 45 data sets. Well, three data sets were due from each agency's within 45 days. And hundreds of data sets were put up, meeting the deadline. I don't believe any of them has been charged with inaccuracy. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of data sets with a short deadline. We'll see. But basically, the Deputy Director of OMB is in charge of that. We have guidance coming on that. And we are very committed to data quality. And we want your help, by the way. If it turns out that some of the data, this is the dispersed knowledge point, and this is kind of the beauty of participation, transparency, and collaboration. If the data isn't right, tell us. Fix it.
Hi. My name is Harold Feld. I'm actually one of the speakers on one of the panels this afternoon, could not resist asking. I've been in the practice of administrative public policy for about 10 years now, and have therefore seen the sort of the last gasp of the pre-Chicago school style of analysis as it's taken hold in all aspects of government policy, sort of the rise of the what you've characterized as the homo economicus, and I would say it is deeply embedded at the moment in agencies after having spent many years being the dominant mode of thought. And I wonder if you can perhaps say on a practical level, given the enormous nature of the federal government, the fact that many decisions are processed and critical data for ultimate decisions come in at levels at the career level where this has been the dominant mode of thought for some time. It's not going to go away very quickly. How do you see, at a kind of practical level, implementing the sort of points and agenda that you've laid out here?
Well, thanks for that. I do, I see the sheer size of the federal government as a very interesting data point. But on the particular three things that I've mentioned, the Open Government Project has been received with such enthusiasm and creativity by the agencies that there's far from being any resistance to that. There's just, it's like seeding a beautiful garden, I think, so far. And the agencies are very eager to embrace transparency. If you go to, this shows how my, instead of thinking about the Red Sox and the Chicago Bulls, I think about what about /open, meaning if you go to epa.gov/open, what's up there now? That's something required by the Open Government Directive, /open it's called, and HHS/open. They all have /opens. They all met their deadline, and they're very impressive. Take a look at if you really have a lot of time on your hands, or if enthusiasm is developing, look at Peace Corps / Open. It's very exciting there. In terms of humanized cost-benefit analysis, put the behavioral stuff to one side. The notion of taking account of qualitative as well as quantitative information, caring about future generations, attending to distributional issues where relevant, that's not something that it's intuitive. So if there's a climate change issue, future generations are matter. If there's a regulation involving disabled people, fairness matters. The regulation eliminating the HIV entry ban, everyone realized and didn't, you know, there wasn't a disagreement that there were humanitarian, you know, people are going to be able to unite with their family members. That's a benefit, sure, but to see it as identical to its monetary equivalent would miss something. So that's something that EPA in particular is very alert to. On the behavioral side, there are people with backgrounds in behavioral approaches all over the government. So Michael Barr at the Treasury Department is a great expert. Peter Orszag, head of OMB, is a great expert. Larry Summers knows a great deal about this. All over the government, people are interested in this. And what I would say is it was a little bit in the early 80s to see behavioral economics in the American Economic Review would be a surprise. But now, in 2010, it's all over the place. So to see, you know, the power of simplification, the potential uses of default rules, the fact that you can't just, you know, throw 40 pages of dense material at people and consider them informed. It has to be suited to how people process information. That's it's kind of in the it's around now. So the career staff at the agency is very impressive, often up on the latest literature. So despite the size point, this has not been the creativity often comes from there.
Hi, Professor Sunstein. Amit Narang, Administrative Law Review. Mm-hmm. You've long been one of the most forceful and eloquent proponents of effective, innovative, and transparent regulatory action. And I think that was clearly reflected in your remarks today. So I think the next question follows naturally. Given the current gridlock in Congress on key legislation, you know, healthcare reform and energy, just to name the most publicized examples, would you and your office encourage federal agencies to increasingly pursue rulemaking under existing authority as a way to address these policy issues, or would you be concerned that that might run afoul of the public and the courts? And as a short addendum to that question, I'd like your assessment on if you think that we're starting to achieve a certain critical mass when it comes to establishing the social norms that you talked about, which would be conducive to more regulation, more regulatory action.
Okay, that's a very good kind of deep question. I guess I think the two lodestars for someone who's at the head of OIRA are first the law and second the president's commitments. So if the law calls for certain action or prohibits certain action, that's it. That can make things easy. If the president wants to move in a certain direction, then that's also defining, subject to the law. I guess I would say what we'd like to do in the various domains I've discussed is if the law calls for something that involves environmental protection, by all means. If the president is committed to pursuing a certain course, by all means. And those, and there might not be a third thing, really. So I don't think it would be right for me in my role to say, to think macro about Congress versus, but It's clear that the Secretary of Transportation puts a great premium on safety on the highways. And there are authorities there. This isn't a matter of bypassing Congress. These are authorities given by Congress that he's exercising. The First Lady is very focused on childhood obesity, and that's something that cuts across many agencies. The Department of Agriculture, EPA has a concern there. The FDA has a very strong concern there. This is something that we are thinking about all over the government. And there are things that could be done legislatively. That's not my domain. My domain is what on the regulatory side can we be helpful with. And I mentioned the FDA has spoken about various initiatives to help kids eat healthy, and we're looking forward to working with them on those.
Great, thank you.
Hi, Jenna Hudson. I'm an editor on the Administrative Law Review. In listening to your remarks, I was very interested by the different points you outlined and the different considerations that the administration has overall. But I'm a little bit distressed that it doesn't seem that this has occurred to anyone before. So I was wondering the extent to which it's actually a novel approach versus if there were underpinnings of it previously and it's just coming to the forefront now.
That's also a great question. And I feel reluctant to say a great deal about what happened in previous administrations because I wasn't there. And while I studied it as a professor, I've learned that sometimes you don't get it right from the outside. So I guess what I'd say, I'm going to grope toward an answer to that question, but I'm going to be careful. And the reason I'm going to be careful is I don't want to say something about a predecessor of mine that's not true. But I guess I will say that the open government directive from the Office of Management and Budget following the President's memoranda in January 2009, that's huge and without precedent. So if you look at data.gov, that's a creation of this administration. If you look at the material there from the various agencies, within less than 2 months after the directive, all these data sets came out. This has never been done before. So this enterprise of democratizing data and seeing how it can help promote the agency's regulatory goals in a way that's alert to the economic environment we find ourselves in, that's really new. On the cost-benefit analysis side, we take very seriously the future generations' distributional considerations, fairness. I don't know that I want to make a direct comparison to the previous administration on that count, but I do want to underline the examples I gave involving the elimination of the HIV entry ban, the social cost of carbon figures, our treatment of passenger protections. I guess I'd give one more example, which is the EPA recently announced regulation, air pollution regulation involving placements of monitors. And while I really don't like to talk about anything that we were involved in, the assistant administrator of the EPA did say recently that this is a significant win for public health in a way that has an environmental justice component. And that we're proud not to have been not entirely not involved in. environmental justice is something that that matters. And I wouldn't want to make much of a comparison to previous administrations, but we have done a great deal on the environmental front. I hope we've done it in a way that's very conscious of the current economic environment, but that protects the American people. On the behavioral side, that has not been a prominent theme before in any administration. So this president has emphasized the immense power of default rules and automatic enrollment in savings policy, which is a very important issue for the future. That's completely new. There was a lot of talk about simplifying financial aid forms. We've actually done it. We have a lot more that's in the works. So the OSHA was not extremely active under the previous administration, let's just say that. This hazard communication rule came out very quickly. There are hearings on it now. We think we're going to save dozens of lives every year, and it's going to be very friendly to workers, both in terms of making the workplace safer and informing them. Fatality information on OSHA.gov, that had never been done before. So these two of them at least are pretty new, and it may be very new.
Thank you.